This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 13th. Every Tuesday at this time, you can find out how to spend less and have more and have your personal finance questions answered by certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And each week, Kevin shares information and advice on timely money matters. Today, what low mortgage interest rates could mean for your house, plus tips for older workers looking for or in part-time jobs, and how smart are your assets when it comes to life insurance? And are you in the market for an iPad? Is this a good time to buy one? Information on all these topics and more, including your personal finance questions, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Madison and Eau Claire, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Are you enjoying these cooler fall temperatures?
I'm ready for it. I feel like the time from about August 14th to September 12th was the best summer we've had in a long time. So I'm satisfied. Let's spring winter on.
Yeah, it's the signs are certainly out there. The grocery store that I go to used to have big boxes of watermelons outside of the door just before you walked in the door, and they have been replaced with pumpkins. So The time is here.
Careful, they may have just painted the watermelons orange.
It could be. You never know.
Common tactic.
I should take a closer look at those. Well, once again, Kevin, mortgage interest rates are way down there. They have plunged to a point we've never seen before, and this means something different, I suppose, to whether you want to buy or if you want to refinance or maybe we want to wait a little bit longer. How should we make these decisions?
Well, I'm glad that interest rates on mortgages keep dropping. I think they were about 7% when we first started doing this show way back in the 1950s and are all the way down to 4% now. So as long as they keep dropping, we will keep talking about it. The national rate is about 3.5% for a 15-year fixed rate mortgage, and a 30-year is just a shade under 4%. 3.98% is the national average. However, there is a growing spread between those rates and what the average mortgage is actually written at, because people may not have quite strong enough credit, or they might have enough equity in their homes to get that best rate. So don't be disappointed if you don't get the best rate, but it's highly likely that if you do go back to get a new mortgage now, you should be getting something close to 4% in the 30-year range and under 4% for that amount. So people who are thinking about buying their first home or buying a new home, or current homeowners who want to stay in their home but may want to refinance, should be happy about this news. And also, there could be some good news on the way for people who are underwater on their homes, meaning they owe more on their mortgages than the homes are actually worth.
Well, we'll talk a little about that in just a moment, but why don't we start with those who are shopping for a new home right now?
It's a great time to buy, because the end of the summer is typically the end of the home selling season, because a lot of people want to move into their new home before school starts so they can get the family settled and get the kids off to school from the new home. So a lot of people who are looking to sell have lost a huge potential buying market. Prices are down in general, with rates at all-time lows, and lenders still willing to lend. They're not quite as accommodating as they were maybe in 4 or 5 years ago, but they are still willing to lend. However, you should only buy a new home if you plan on living there at least 5 to 10 years. You should not get a mortgage that is worth more than 2 to 3 times your gross annual household income. So let's say a person or a couple makes $60,000 a year. They generally shouldn't have a mortgage that's worth more than $120,000 to $180,000. You should try to put the minimum down that the lender will allow, take the loan out for the maximum amount, get a 30-year mortgage, and get a fixed-rate mortgage. And a lot of people who are buying new homes will be concerned about paying PMI, private mortgage insurance, if they do put a low down payment. If the only cash you have is money that would otherwise go to the down payment that would then eliminate the need for PMI. You're still better off paying the PMI and keeping the cash on hand in case you have to do something with the house or you have a short-term financial crunch and you need to use that money to make the payments and stay in the house until you can figure out a solution.
So what about those who might be interested in refinancing right now?
Well, the same advice applies, but with a kicker. The maximum amount they should get is what the lender will allow, which will typically be about 80% of the loan to value. So I wouldn't say they should go all the way to the 90%. However, they may want to get not only a 30-year mortgage for 80% of the loan to value, but also a home equity line of credit against the other 20%. So if they do have some other emergency, that 20% can constitute a pretty significant dollar amount for these people. So they have the home equity line of credit in place. They'll be able to tap that in an emergency without having to go back to the lender to apply for it. Now, if people say, well, I can pay this mortgage off, but I'm still going to have $50,000 or $60,000 left over after I do that, what should I do with this money? Well, first of all, you should pay off any high interest debt that you have, like credit card or car loans or even student loans. Second of all, you might want to max out your pre-tax savings if you are working into a 401k or an IRA if you can. That'll give you an instant return in the form of a lower tax bill. And finally, you may want to just set that cash aside in the bank or in a CD and use that cash for future purchases like a car or some home improvements for which you'd otherwise have to borrow. And so that way you can use cash. You already have borrowed it at a very low interest rate. When you go to the bank or the credit union and you try to get a new mortgage, you can expect that you're probably going to pay about 2% or so of the value of the mortgage in closing costs. So if you're getting a $200,000 mortgage, you're probably going to have at least $4,000 to $5,000 in total closing costs. And finally, if you don't like what you get from one lender, shop around. A lot of other banks and credit unions are interested in helping people out right now and making loans. And if you don't like the one you see at one place, go down the street and see what they have to say.
And what kind of help might be on the way for those who owe more than their home is worth?
Well, this is still in the rumor stage, but President Obama and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke have alluded to a program that may allow underwater homeowners to refinance their mortgages and pay off whatever they owe and get a new 4% 30-year mortgage. Generally, the conditions are that the mortgage has to be through Fannie or Freddie. They also have to be current on their payments as well. The chances are pretty good that this is going to happen, in part because some people are saying this can be done without having to go through Congress to get it approved. I'm not sure how much of an economic boost this will be because I'm guessing people who are in dire enough financial straits to be underwater on their home and not have a good enough position to refinance are probably going to take any savings and put it in the bank. They're not going to spend it, but it's very good for the individual borrowers. And because mortgages are one of the biggest topic areas that we get questions on this show, we'll give a preview here in our membership drive next month. We are going to offer for our On Your Money mini money book to anyone who pledges a long pamphlet for new buyers, current homeowners, and even retired people called Making the Most of Your Mortgage. And that will go to anyone who pledges during the On Your Money pledge drive.
Ooh, good. That'll be, I'm looking forward to that. Making the Most of Your Mortgage, the thank you gift when we have our pledge drive in October. At the end of the program, I'll give you the exact date of that program. And we have a caller who has a question about refinancing, so let me take that now. Steve in Green Bay. Hello, Steve.
Hello there. We have a 4% 15-year mortgage currently, which we just had a couple years now, and before that we had a 30-year mortgage since 97. We're just wondering if it would pay for us to drop down, if we could, to the 3.5.
Did you take the mortgage out, Steve, for as much as the lender would allow?
No, we took out just what the house, you know, what we owed on the house, and at 4% and the 15-year mortgage. We're also having the money taken every 2-week period, so we could get it paid off quicker.
Okay. Well, a couple things about that. I don't think it would make sense to go from 4 to 3.5, especially if you go with a larger bank or credit union. You're probably going to pay a lot in closing costs, and you won't really get that much of a savings off of it. And especially if you're paying it down faster than it needs to be, the amount of closing costs are going to be spread out over a shorter period of time, so they're going to be higher on a per payment basis. So I wouldn't do that. What I would say, you probably won't go along with this, but other people might, is that you should refinance. And if you do, you should refinance for the 30-year at 4% rather than the 15-year, especially if you have other needs that you have to pay for either now or coming up. And even people who say, you know what, Kevin, I like the 15-year mortgage because I like the idea of paying this thing down faster. You can take out a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. And generally, if you make the payment that the 15-year mortgage alternative would have required, you will still pay the 30-year mortgage off within about 15 and a half years. But if for whatever reason, either interest rates go up or you have a better need or a greater need for the money that you were using to pay down the mortgage, you can stop making those extra payments and extend the mortgage out longer. I really feel that people have a very difficult time ever borrowing at rates this low for a valuation and terms that are this favorable. So I wouldn't refinance to the 3.5, but if you are going to go through with a refinance, I'd actually extend it out to the 30-year.
All right, Steve, thanks for calling and good luck to you. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He's the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decision. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for our On Your Money email bag, and a listener, Kevin, says she was a nurse for 30 years and now she wants to apply for a part-time job in retail. She wants to know, should she omit her personal experience from her resume?
Well, personal experience is yes.
Oh, professional experience.
Sorry, professional. She probably, yeah, okay, good. Yeah, I've put a lot of my personal experiences on my resume in the past and it didn't help. Let's just put it that way. Pictures were even worse. That was
the
dumbest idea.
No, but you don't want to admit your professional experience.
Absolutely not. Well, first of all, nurses work very hard, harder than a lot of us do. And so someone who was able to do that and do it well for 30 years, that's a badge of honor. The employer will definitely ask, hey, what did you do for these 3 decades that are not accounted for on your resume? And you don't want to lie to start it off. Nobody should lie on their resume. You should just enhance the positive parts of it. She should be proud of it, though. There's probably some concern to say, hey, if I just try to get, you know, a part-time job in retail, they might think I'm overqualified or that I won't be on the job for very long. But if you state your reasons for wanting this part-time job very clearly and say, look, I've worked under pressure, I've worked under difficult conditions, life and death conditions for many nurses, I think that most employers would be happy to have someone with your work ethic and talents and ability and history and longevity joining their work staff.
Do you hear a lot about or from older workers looking for jobs or looking for part-time work even after they retire?
Yes, surprisingly, it's usually because they either want to or they have to. Sometimes they have to do it for the money and they have to do it because they need health care insurance and the Medicare doesn't kick in for several years until they turn 65, and they can't afford or they aren't able to obtain health insurance on their own. And so some people also want to because they just like the extra money. And for those people who want to, and it can actually work out to a really neat deal, especially after they cross over into Medicare qualifications, because they are, you know, the employer says, hey, you're willing to work here part-time. I can kind of, you know, give you your hours as I need you. You can come and tell me when you need to work, when you need time off. I don't have to put you on our health insurance rolls. I don't have to feel bad about cutting your hours. You know, you're the first person this week who actually passed the drug test. You come from a generation with a great work ethic. It can work out really well for the employer, and it can work out well for the worker because the worker gets something to do and still feel valuable and lend some skills and make a little money in the process.
What financial advice do you have for older workers who do have part-time jobs?
It depends on the category. If they're doing it because they have to, they should definitely keep any cash aside that they possibly can. Don't pay off any debt that you don't have to, and especially a mortgage. And if you do have home equity accumulated, open up a home equity line of credit as soon as possible so that if you do lose this part-time job, you can tap that home equity line of credit to cover some emergencies without having to sell your home. You should only contribute to the retirement plan for this part-time job just to get any employer match. And if you still want to save for your looming retirement and you have the money to do so, it's probably best to do it in the Roth IRA. And it does get better. Once you do cross over where you qualify for Social Security and, better yet, for Medicare, if you're in the working part-time for money, you're so used to scrimping and saving that these semi-guaranteed checks and insurance can really make a difference. Now, if you're doing it because you want to do it, you should actually max out your retirement plan savings and make any contributions that you can for your spouse as well. The only thing to watch out for with Social Security is if you start collecting Social Security before your normal retirement age, which is usually 66 or 67, you can only earn so much in Social Security before your other earnings can actually reduce your Social Security payments. I think it's $14,160 for this year. Your spousal earnings do not count. Your spousal Social Security isn't affected by your earnings, but just watch out because that can actually reduce your benefit if you make too much money.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. With us every Tuesday or just about every Tuesday at this time, for On Your Money, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for Kevin, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll have some information on life insurance and what type of life insurance is best for you. And Kevin also has some advice, some tips on the iPad and if you are in the market for an iPad. That's coming up.
I need somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone
help. Well, if you need some help with your personal finance matters, Kevin McKinley is here to help. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Maureen in West Bend. Hello, Maureen.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
My situation is we have two properties, our home, and we also have a rental that is an office with some residences on it. And I was wondering, we have mortgages on both. Would it make sense? We have a lot of equity, and we have equity in both of them. Would it make sense to just get a large home mortgage and pay off the rental property mortgage? Because we're getting quoted like a rate of 6.25, we have a mortgage there that renews every 3 years. You know, would it make sense to just get a larger mortgage at the 3.5% versus having, you know, one mortgage at 6.25, and then our home mortgage currently is at 4.75?
Yeah, I actually would do that, especially if I'm guessing that the equity in both your home and the rental property constitute a fairly significant portion of your net worth. And so if you're able to do that, primary residential loans usually come at much favorable terms than commercial lending. And so if you're able to have this paid-for building that probably generates fairly good cash flow for you, even after you have to pay the expenses and deal with the normal headaches and hassles that a landlord has to undergo, you've locked in a guaranteed payment, if you will, on the loan for that commercial property. But if we experience any inflation whatsoever, you'll probably be able to raise those rents a little bit on an ongoing basis, or maybe even a lot. So after it'll not only serve as kind of a cash flow hedge for you because you have the cash from the residential mortgage, but you will also be able to use it as an inflation hedge because the fixed mortgage payment will always be the same, and I would recommend you do it for the 30 years, and you'll probably be able to raise up your rent a little bit more every single year, and if you can do that, pretty soon you'll more than offset even the interest cost of the new mortgage. So yes, that sounds like a good plan.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maureen. And now we go to Arlene in Clintonville. Hello, Arlene.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question for Kevin is, with the FDIC insurance that covers up to $250,000 right now, Kevin, does that expire in 2012, or does that go beyond that?
That's a great question, and it's been kind of a gray area. It was, I think it was 2 years ago, they actually made it permanent, but I've heard some rumblings that they may choose to not do that. And normally, you know, the $100,000 limit that was previously established, that was around for what seemed like decades. And then they bumped it up, and they've done some things in terms of the lending limits that are kind of almost behind the scenes orchestration of trying to get people to move money into a favored area. And sometimes they might, the concern that I have for that FDIC insurance is that at some point they might say, you know what, people aren't spending money, or they're not investing it. They're just loading up at the banks. Banks can't lend it out profitably. Maybe we should lower the deposit limit so that they can, so they're forced to do something else with the money. That's a very unlikely scenario, but it's something that I could see happening. So we'll check on that. We're going to talk a little bit about CDs again in a few weeks. But yes, as far as I know, the $250,000 limit on insured savings at an institution per saver is still in place and will be for the foreseeable future.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Arlene. Well, we have callers waiting to talk to Kevin, and one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin, let's get right into the smart assets segment of the show. September is Life Insurance Awareness Month, and it looks like it's a good time to revisit whether we should be buying or keeping life insurance policies. You know, I have to admit, I don't have one. Am I, should I?
Well, are you aware that life insurance exists?
I am aware.
You are aware? Good, because that's the whole goal of this month. I'm so glad that these, you know, industry trade groups keep coming up with these hackneyed months and weeks and days or whatever. I don't know what I would do for topic ideas if I didn't have my trusty public relations official.
It's good to talk about, because there are different types of life insurance policies. This, you know, whole versus term, and you know, I don't have any children, and you know,
at least
really...
none that you know of,
right?
Oh, wait
I don't,
a minute,
yeah, I would
no,
know.
That wouldn't be
I
right.
would
Never
know.
Mind.
But I, you know, so I'm in the group that has no policy at all. So you can scold me later. But what should we keep in mind?
Well, most people probably don't have the life insurance that is right for them. They either have no policy at all, they don't have enough life insurance, they have the wrong kind of life insurance, or they have a life insurance policy and they don't need it anymore and they don't know what to do with it.
All right, so let's start with the no policy at all, folks.
Well, this would usually be new parents, mm-hmm. and people who getting caught up with all the feathering their nest and, you know, repainting the bassinet and everything have neglected to invite an insurance salesperson into their living room. They never got around to it. They're not sure what kind. They don't want to make a mistake. So the inertia reigns supreme. The best kind of life insurance for parents of young children is term life insurance. This is very inexpensive life insurance, but it generally lasts for a certain term. And when people have small children, they want that term to last until the kids will be adults and hopefully on their own and financially independent. So if you have a 5-year-old, you probably want a term life insurance policy that lasts at least 15 years and probably 20 years. And you want the life insurance on both working parents and parents who are stay-at-home, because if you're in a couple and the breadwinner survives and the stay-at-home parent doesn't, I like to have the breadwinner have the option at least of having enough money to quit his or her job so that he or she can stay home and take care of this kid.
How much life insurance do they need?
Generally, these people would need enough to make the survivors financially independent, which according to the On Your Money official formula is about 200 to 300 times their monthly expenses. So if they go through their monthly expenses and they find that they're spending, say, about $4,000 per month, they would need about $800,000 to $1 million left to cover that and make sure that the people were only working because they wanted to, not because they have to. And again, hopefully on each parent.
That sounds like it could get expensive.
It will be if they buy the wrong kind of insurance. And generally, if you have a person in a nice tie who's giving you free pens and won't leave your family room until you sign the contract, you are probably buying the wrong kind of life insurance. Cash value life insurance definitely has its place, especially for people who are business owners or who are concerned about estate taxes, if they should pass away and what their inheritors will pay. And that could be a really neat vehicle for savings as well. But in this case, term life insurance is what they should get. And according to the website termforsale.com, a 20-year, $500,000 policy for a 30-year-old male costs about $25 per month in good health. And for a female in the good health, it costs about $20 per month. So it's not fun to spend money on this, but it's a lot more affordable than many people think it would be.
All right. What about old non-parents? Do we need
people who aren't don't have anyone waiting on their death or depending on their income?
Right.
You've got this policy. It's usually a minimal amount. If you've had it more than 20 years, it's usually a good idea to keep it. The Consumer Federation of America did a study, and they found that 20 years is kind of the cutoff point, where if you've been paying into it for that long, it probably makes sense to keep it going and even pay the premiums on it, because the value of it is accumulated so well. If it's anything less than that, you don't need the insurance anymore. You probably want to let it lapse, or maybe use it to convert it to a new type of policy, or even use the proceeds for a term policy that might be more appropriate for you. We will talk in a few weeks, though, how people in that situation can use that policy to help out their family, help out their situation, and even pay for long-term care expenses out of the cash value of the policy.
You know, Kevin, I guess I was also getting to someone in my boat, or maybe even older, no children. We don't have health insurance policies. I see these ads on TV for, you know, Colonial Penn and other ads geared to old people like me. Should I pick one of those up?
I would say not, unless you said, you know what, this is something from an emotional standpoint. It would feel good to me. I have either some family members or some friends or a charity that I would like to help upon my death. And so I'm going to buy this policy and I'm going to pay a little bit onto it as long as I can afford. And if I die while the policy's in force, somebody will get a big bunch of money. Usually those ones that are advertising on TV probably aren't the best way to go. You're better off going with one with an established insurance agency whatsoever. And also, I wouldn't want you to get, to be overinsured anyway, because
You never know.
There's always the danger that, you know, there's going to be a dispute at home or something and your husband's going to end up on 48 hours. And it's all so unseemly that
That's why we don't have it.
That's a good point.
We do have a caller who has a question about life insurance, though. Barbara in Madison. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, we've had a policy probably for 30 years, and so we've accumulated some money in that policy. We also have term life. Just a few years ago, we bought some term life insurance. Our children are 20 and 22, and I'm wondering if we should close our whole life policy and put it in a Roth IRA or a CD. I'll be 59 and a half in about a year and a half, so I'm wondering if we should do something like that and save that money.
I would say probably not, especially since it's been that long, and especially since you may not even know the answer to this, Barbara, but I'm guessing that there's an interest rate paid on that policy, like 3 or 4%, right?
Yes, there is.
Okay. That's not as safe as a CD or even a treasury bond, but it's pretty safe. And that rate is so competitive in this low interest rate environment for something that not only is paying you a really nice fixed rate, it has some tax advantages, and it has a death benefit. I would be very hesitant at this time, unless you needed the money for an emergency, I'd be very hesitant to cash that out, simply because that fixed interest rate that they're currently paying is pretty good. New policies probably aren't going to get that high of a rate for 30 years. And so I would have you actually hang on to it just because the rate is so good. If the rate finally does drop down to 2 or 3% or something, then you might look elsewhere for the proceeds. And again, if you haven't purchased long-term care insurance yet, there is a way that you can take annuity and life insurance policies and convert them with relative ease to long-term care insurance. And again, we'll have to talk about that in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Barbara. And now Maria in Glendale is with us. Hello, Maria.
Oh, hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for your show, too. My question is that I don't know how to find out how much my condo is worth. It's right in Glendale, and I got it for about $127,000, and right now the mortgage is $120,000. I have tried to refinance, but I've been turned down because I guess there isn't enough equity, and because they say that the value of the home has gone down, of the condo has gone down. And how do I go about finding out exactly how much it's worth? And number two, question two, is there anything that I can do or government help that I can get so that I can refinance without being turned down by the banks?
Yeah, very common occurrence, especially with condo owners. Condo prices have, in many places, have experienced a huge drop, much bigger than primary residential homes. And the problem, of course, with a condo is that not only do you have the value of the condo, but you have condo association fees. And the more that those go up, the harder it is to sell, and therefore the lower the value is. Sadly, Maria, the condo is probably worth whatever the appraiser from the bank put it at, and even then, that's still just what the bank is willing to lend the value on. What's probably even a lower number is what someone with cash is willing to pay for it. That's the only way to find out what the true value is. And your question, of course, is if you do put it up for sale, how low are you willing to go to accept a price to get out of it? And then also, how do you make up the difference between the value of the mortgage and what you get for the condo? There are a couple assistance places that can help people. I would definitely recommend you try to stay as current on the mortgage payments as you possibly can. And I would also say that just to stay tuned to the government programs, because I'm not sure that this will actually help condo loans, especially if they didn't go through Fannie and Freddie. But this new program is really designed for help homeowners like you who owe more on the home than it's worth, where they would give you the proceeds to pay off what you owe and then allow you to start over a new 4% 30-year mortgage. Again, I'm not sure that this will come to fruition, and if it does, if it will help condo owners, but there may be some help for you in the meantime. I will put up a couple of links to mortgage assistance programs that are sponsored by the government at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. So go to there, and there'll be some places you can go to try to get some help.
Okay. Is it worth mentioning that this is a WIRA loan?
I don't know enough about the program to say one way or the other. But again, hang on. And actually, if you are having trouble with it, did you contact the people at WIRA?
No, I did not.
Okay, that would be my first step. You will not be the first person even today, Maria, to call the WIDA's Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, which helps people get into homes, and among other things. I would contact them. You will not be the first person to call them and say, hey, I'm having trouble with this. My value is way more than the mortgage is way more than the value of this place. Or do I have any options for it? And if anybody should know, they would know what you can do with it. So contact them. You don't have anything to be embarrassed about. You're just trying to come up with the best solution that's legal and right for you.
Good luck to you, Maria, and thank you so much for calling. We have one open line for you now, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And again, Kevin will be posting various links and information on the onyourmoney.com website a little bit later on today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Well, money can't buy us love, but it can buy us an iPad. If you haven't bought an iPad yet, Kevin says you may want to hold off a little longer. Really, Kevin? I want to hold off on buying an iPad?
Yeah, and that's difficult to do if you don't have one yet, because everyone who has it is a proselytizer about it's the greatest thing ever, and their blood count is, white blood cell count is down, and their heart blood pressure is down, and it's just they've lost weight. It's just fantastic.
I know. It's a miracle worker, and it's really popular, too.
It's one of the fastest-selling products in history, ousted only by the iPhone. So Apple seems to know what they're doing here. It's a tablet computer, and the iPad 2, which is the most current version, currently costs between $500 and about $800, depending on the model and the size of the memory that you get in it, and whether it has Wi-Fi capability or not. They are currently selling about an iPad every second.
Oh my gosh.
They sell more iPads in a week than most of the competitors of theirs have sold in total. And Steve Jobs says the market share of iPad of tablet computers right now is about 90%. Others say it's probably closer to 70 to 80%. But even if the lower number is right, it's still an amazing market share for what is becoming the only way that many people use a computer.
But aren't other companies making these tablet PCs? Are there any competitors, good competitors out there?
Yeah, there are a couple ones. Samsung makes one, a 10-inch one on the Android platform, which runs about $400 to $500. And it's gotten really good reviews from places like Consumer Reports. HP Hewlett-Packard came out with a tablet just a few months ago. It was going to be a new operating system, and it was going to be their iPad killer. Well, within a few months, they said, you know what, the heck with this. We can't compete. So they had an interesting thing where they dropped the price down from about $400 to $500 all the way down to $99 just to get rid of them. Well, there was a huge frenzy for people saying, you know what, I know it's not an iPad, but for $99, I'll buy this thing. And people were searching, waiting in line at Best Buy and going online and trying to open up the accounts, and they were selling out like crazy. So HP has said, well, maybe we'll make a few more of these, or we'll sell the ones that we could still have in our inventory at $99. That kind of established the price point of what people are willing to pay for a tablet computer that is not an iPad, somewhere in the $100 to $200 range. There are some interesting developments coming down the road. Amazon is going to come out with kind of a Kindle color version that will serve as a tablet computer. It'll be at around $250. Some people have said they might offer free 3G, which means that you could be anywhere and get internet access for free. I don't think that's going to happen. What's more likely is they're going to give a free Amazon Prime membership, which costs about $79 per year, but it allows you to get expedited shipping on products you purchase through Amazon, and also free access to their library of, I think there's probably about 7,000 or 8,000 movies and TV shows that you can watch on this. Google has tried to come out with a tablet as well. It hasn't done as well, but Google did just adopt a lot of Motorola technology, so there might be one after the first of the year, too.
Wow, sounds interesting. So what if we decide that we want to go ahead and buy an iPad? What's not to like?
Other than the price, there's not a whole lot not to like on this. It's great for small children. It's great for older people because it's much easier to use and see, and you can expand the screen type and font much easier so that if you have trouble manipulating around a normal laptop or PC, the iPad is usually going to be easier to use. They have about 90,000 apps. These are small programs that you can buy usually either for free or for a couple bucks that you can buy in the iPad app store. The thing that you're not going to like, if you normally like to compose text, there are word processing programs that you can use on the iPad, but it's very difficult to type on it. There are keyboard adapters that you can get for maybe $50 to $150 that where you slide the iPad in, but it's still not quite the same as having an integrated keyboard like you normally do with a laptop. If you do want that, you might want to just go with a MacBook instead. And also, after the first of the year, if you like the iPad but you want the leading edge of technology, the iPad 3 is expected to come out after probably February, March of next year at the earliest, and it'll be at the same price point, but it'll probably be thinner, probably have a few more features on it, might even be faster.
Sounds good. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We have a number of callers waiting, so let's hit the phones again. Paul in Eau Claire. Hello, Paul.
Hi. My question is, some financial institutions are giving 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, but they have a POD feature. And what is the danger of that paid-on-demand feature? on a 30-year fix. Isn't that not a 30-year fix, really, because they can demand the money at any time?
Yeah, are these standard credit unions and banks, Paul?
Yes.
Okay. One of the great features of a 30-year mortgage is that as long as you make each one of those 360 payments on time, there's no way that they can accelerate it for you, and you can't in turn, if for whatever reason, if you decide to pay it off, you can do that usually with little or no penalty. I would be very concerned about any agreement where there is a POD feature, where you're saying the lender can come to you and say, hey, we want our money back right now.
Right. It's hidden in the mortgage in the note that it says POD, and then it's paid on demand. And
I've never heard of such a thing.
Their excuse for that is, well, it only once in a great while. Only once in the history of our company do we have to do that. But I mean, it borders on fraud, I would think, because they're sucking people in with a 30-year fixed rate. But then it can be demanded at any time that the credit union or the bank demands it.
Yeah, for better or for worse, the fact that it is in the agreement and you did find it and you did address it means that they are, you know, you're signing the agreement saying that I've read this whole thing. Not very many people actually read the whole things, but I haven't heard a lot about that. We'll check into that and see how common that is. But I would be very hesitant about taking out the 30-year mortgage in that case because you don't know what your financial situation would be at a given moment that you'll be able to scrape up, you know, $150,000 in cash or have to refinance at new higher terms. So I would be very concerned about that if that were the case. And just their word that, well, we've never had to do this before, I'm not sure that that would allow me any extra sleep at night, if you will.
Right.
Yeah, Paul, thanks very much for the call. Michelle in Portage is with us now. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Kevin and Joy. I have a question going back to insurance. When I purchased some term insurance about a year or two ago, at that time they had asked me if I wanted to purchase insurance, term insurance for both my college-age students. And I didn't at that time, and I'm wondering if maybe I should have. Her reason she gave me that I should buy it is down the road, it's cheaper for them, and then they'll be able to afford it when they have families or if they should develop some sort of illness or something that prevents them from getting the insurance. So I'm wondering if I should purchase it for them. And then one other question on my own policy, when I purchased it, they asked if I wanted to pay like $5.95 a month extra or something for a disability type coverage. Yeah, so if I became disabled and couldn't make my payment, they would make it for me. So I'm wondering if I should have done that.
Yeah, I for the 20-some years that I've done this, 23 years now, I normally would say, no, you don't need life insurance on children because, sadly, if they should pass away, it actually enhances your financial situation because you don't have to support them. Where I would say that in this situation, first of all, if you were to get it for your, you know, young adult children, term insurance is the only way I would go. I wouldn't use this as a savings vehicle. And second of all, one instance where I could say, you know what, this is something you should really get is if you took out a lot of money in student loans to get those kids a college education, you're saying that, you know, their earnings or your earnings are going to pay those loans back. I wouldn't be averse to getting a term life insurance policy. Say, you know what, no offense, this is cheap insurance for 10 years until these loans get paid off. Just in case you can't earn it, it would create a big financial hardship if I had to pay this back and didn't have your earnings to help. That's an instance I would say it. The time to not get life insurance on kids, and I think this is one of the biggest ethical and moral transgressions in the financial services industry, is when Gerber sends new parents this beautiful picture of a baby on their thing and said, what happens if your baby can't get life insurance in the future? Why don't you buy a life insurance policy? I find it repulsive that this company that is providing food and nourishment to my baby is also wants to sell me something that supposedly is going to make my situation better if this baby should die an untimely death. So don't buy those policies. The term ones I would definitely look at. And the disability one, it's pretty cheap. There's probably a lot of hoops you'd have to jump through to actually get that enacted. But if it makes you feel better, Michelle, get it. If you say, I'm not worried about it, then don't get it.
Okay, okay. And I didn't get it, and I guess I'm just going to stick to that. I'm not going to get it. So, all right, well, thank you very much.
All right, Michelle, thanks very much. So, what a nice mom. Sandy in Baldwin. Hello, Sandy.
Good morning. I have a question about mortgages.
Yes.
Okay. With the way the house, the economy has changed, our house value, according to our taxes, went way down. And so now we owe more than what our taxes are, than what our house is actually worth. We took out a 15-year mortgage about 4 years ago to do some refinancing. What would you suggest we do at this stage? We're in our later years, and I'm still working full-time, but expecting that to change, too, in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, is it the assessed value, what the property taxes are based on? That's what went down?
Yes, tremendously.
Oh, that's wonderful. Because did your property taxes go down along with it?
The property, well, I don't know. I'm hoping so. We'll find out at the end of this year.
Yeah, usually they don't, do they?
I was going to say, Sandy, this is a rarity. The assessors haven't quite opened up a newspaper or a website recently and figured out that the housing market has actually gone down. So you are a rarity to get this. So good for you. That I wouldn't worry about. The notion that that does matter in your situation is what the bank's appraiser thinks your house is worth, and then what the bank is willing to lend on that appraiser's valuation. And appraisers are rightfully becoming more conservative in their appraisals, but not to the point where they're, you know, cutting 30 or 40% off the valuation that they might have given 3 or 4 years ago. So I would go back to the lender. I would say, hey, I just want to see. And I would keep walking down the road of getting a new 30-year mortgage for as much as the lender will allow, and keep going until you actually have to sign on the dotted line. And typically, all you're going to be out is some time and headache and hassle of putting all your information together, plus maybe a few $100 that will have to go to the appraiser. But get to the point where you get everything in place and then decide if it's right to do, rather than saying, no, I'm not even going to go through with it, because there's a lot of work that needs to be done, even when you do decide, I do want a new 30-year mortgage. So I wouldn't be as concerned about what the assessor says. I'd be more concerned about what the appraiser says in your circumstances.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Sandy. Time for Sheree in Waupun. Hello, Sheree.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
We just recently purchased a beautiful single-family home, and we currently own a duplex that we've rented out. Because of the housing market, of course, we want to take advantage and purchase some more property. So we put in a bid for another duplex. We've been told that our debt ratio is higher than most banks want them to be. So we were actually turned down, which was kind of a surprise to us. So because we just purchased this home in April, I'm sure it's not eligible for refinance. Do you have any ideas what we could do to bring that debt ratio down so we can qualify? I mean, it's not even a huge amount, but, you know, it's of concern to us because we really wanted to acquire as much property as possible, you know, as, you know, during this favorable time.
Yep. Nope. You're barking up the right tree, Shred. And I think, especially if you already own one rental property, you kind of know what you're getting into. And I think you should try to buy what you can. That said, sometimes a turn down from the bank is actually not just a wake-up call, but it's good news because the bank says, hey, no offense, but we're not going to lend you the money, but we're also not going to let you get in over your head. So you can try a couple other lenders. I would go to a credit union if you haven't been to one yet. Go to some of the national places and see what they say. You know, mortgages can be commodities, but different lenders have different priorities at different time. And one that said no to you a year ago might say yes now and vice versa. So I would keep trying until you find someone who's willing to work with your unique situation. And then if you still want to go through with it, based on those terms, I would do it. Otherwise, you do have to just keep working to whittle that debt down and go from there.
Is there an option maybe to do something with the mortgage on the other duplex that we currently own? Because we've had it for 10 years, and, you know, there's definitely equity built up. We don't have any line of credit or anything like that out on it.
I would use that equity and put that equity up and say, hey, is it possible to borrow against this to use the proceeds to buy the other place? It's becoming a little more aggressive, but I wouldn't be averse to that at all, again, as long as you know what you're getting into.
Sheree, thank you for the call, and much luck to you. Kevin, time for the website of the week now.
Well, at the age of 45 and a half, I'm embarrassed how much I know about ARP, but then I remember that I'm only 4.5 years away from qualifying. But ARP, AARP, has a really great website devoted to older people who either have to work or want to work and places they can get jobs. And we'll put a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
I will check it out. Time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Thanks very much to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.